Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We appreciate you plugging in with us today. Usually when we talk about the economy, we are zoomed in on the here and now.
Very much so.
We're looking at this quarter's inflation print, or maybe a stock market rally, or perhaps the latest budget announcement. We tend to look at the weather.
Right. We get caught up in the daily fluctuations, the sort of day-to-day noise of the markets.
But today we are doing something different. We aren't looking at the weather. We are looking at the climate history. In fact, to borrow a phrase that came up in our research stack, we are essentially walking onto a crime scene.
A crime scene that spans nearly two centuries involves a calculated extraction of trillions of dollars and essentially explains why the geopolitical map of the world looks the way it does today.
And I want to be clear right off the bat. I'm not using the term crime scene as a dramatic metaphor to get you to keep listening. We are going to trace the entire narrative arc of the Indian economy.
The whole thing.
We are going to go from a colonial extraction engine, literally designed to bleed the country dry, to the temple building era of central planning through the crash of 1991 and right up to the modern global powerhouse we see in late 2025.
It is a massive journey. I mean, it's hard to overstate the scale of it. We are talking about the transition from absolute destitution to the fifth largest economy in the world and potentially the third very, very soon.
And to kick this off, we have to start with a number that frankly blew my mind when I was going through the source material. It comes from the research of the economist Utsa Petnick.
Oh, I know exactly which number you were reaching for. It's impossible to forget once you've seen it.
It's $45 trillion.
$45 trillion.
$45 trillion.
It is a staggering figure. It's almost impossible to visualize. It just doesn't compute in the human brain.
Just to put that in perspective for you listening, the current GDP of the United States, the largest economy in the world, is somewhere around $27 or $28 trillion.
So this is significantly more than the entire annual economic output of modern America.
And this figure, $45 trillion, is the calculated value of the drain from India to Britain between 1765 and 1938.
And understanding that number is the key to the whole story. It sets the baseline. You cannot understand why the Indian economy looked the way it did in 1947, why literacy was at 18%, why the savings rate was a measly 9%, why the industrial base was shattered, without understanding that for 200 years, the economic engine was running in reverse.
Running in reverse, that's a great way to put it.
It wasn't generating wealth for India. It was, in fact, generating capital for Britain's Industrial Revolution.
So here is our roadmap for this deep dive. We are going to break this massive history down into four distinct acts. First, we unpack the crime scene, the actual mechanics of that colonial extraction. How do you steal $45 trillion without anyone, you know, noticing?
How does the magic trick work?
Yeah.
Then we move to the architects. The post-independence attempt to build a modern economy from scratch using Soviet-style central planning.
Which takes us to the third act, the crisis and crossing of 1991. The moment the money ran out, the gold was flown to London and everything changed.
The Big Bang moment.
And finally, we will land in the modern era. We'll look at the financial architecture that keeps the system stable today, the fierce debates over how we measure poverty, and we'll go right up to the present day late 2025 and early 2026 to discuss the massive policy shifts we've just seen with the new Grameen employment mission.
It's a huge scope, but it all connects.
It's a journey from a $45 trillion loss to a $4 trillion GDP. Let's get into it.
Let's do it.
Okay, part one, the crime scene. We talked about the drain of wealth, but how did it actually work? I think most people assume colonialism was just unfair trade buying cheap and selling dear, you know, taking spices and giving back glass beads.
That's the common misconception. And look, there was plenty of that, but if it were just unfair trade, India would have just been poor. It wouldn't have been structurally decimated. The sources point to something much more insidious.
Which is?
It's a concept called the transfer of tribute.
Transfer of tribute? That sounds medieval. Break that down for us.
Okay, so think about a normal trade relationship, say between the U.S. and France today. If I, in the U.S., buy wine from you in France, I give you dollars. You keep those dollars. You can use them to invest in your vineyard, pay your workers, or, and this is the important part, buy goods from me.
Right, it's a two-way street. Value for value. Goods move one way, financial value moves the other. It's a circle.
Exactly. But under the colonial system, there was a unilateral transfer. It wasn't a circle, it was a one-way pipe. India was exporting goods, massive amounts of cotton, jute, opium, grain, but getting no economic return for it.
But wait, surely money was changing hands. The British traders weren't just, you know, walking into farms and taking the cotton at gunpoint, right? I mean, on the ground, the Indian farmer was getting paid something.
He was. Technically, yes. But this is where you have to follow the money. This is where the scam reveals itself. It's a mechanism called the council bill system.
Okay, this was a part of the research that made me stop and reread it three times because it is so diabolical in its simplicity. Walk us through a transaction. Let's say I'm a British trader in London. I want to buy Indian cotton. What do I do?
Okay, you are in London. You have gold or sterling. You want Indian cotton. But you don't send that gold to India. That's the key. Instead, you walk into the office of the Secretary of State for India, right there in London. You pay him your sterling.
So my money goes to the British government in London.
In London.
Yeah.
In exchange, he gives you a piece of paper, a promissory note, basically, called a council bill.
Okay. So the gold stays in London. It's sitting in the British Treasury. It never gets on a boat.
Precisely. The gold never leaves Britain. Now you, the trader, you take this council bill and you mail it to your agent in India. He takes it to an Indian exporter. The Indian exporter takes this bill to the colonial government office in, say, Calcutta and says, pay me. The government pays him in rupees.
And here is the million-dollar question, or I guess the trillion-dollar question. Where did the colonial government get those rupees to pay the exporter?
That is the kicker. That is the whole trick. Those rupees came from Indian tax revenues.
Wow.
So think about what just happened.
Let me just restate that to make sure I'm processing this correctly and for everyone listening. The Indian peasant pays taxes to the colonial government. The government takes that tax money and uses it to pay the Indian exporter for goods that are then sent to Britain.
Correct.
So effectively, the Indian taxpayer is paying for their own country's exports.
You have nailed it. The British importer gets the goods for free, essentially. The Indian exporter gets paid, sure, but he's paid with his own countrymen's tax money. The goods leave India. No new money enters India. It is what economists call an unrequited export.
That is wild. It's a circular loop of extraction. It's not trade. It's embezzlement on a national scale. It's like someone stealing your TV, but then using the money from your own wallet to pay you for it.
That's a perfect analogy. And this went on for decades, for centuries. And that's just the trade mechanism. Then you have the other side of the ledger, the home charges.
These are the invisible costs the sources mention, the stuff that doesn't show up on a trade bill.
Yes. India had to pay for the privilege of being ruled. The salaries and pensions of British officers who had retired back to England, paid for by the Indian taxpayer.
Wait, not just while they were working in India, but their retirement pensions back in Surrey.
For the rest of their lives. Paid out of the Indian budget, the military charges for wars Britain fought to maintain its empire in Africa or China, charged to India's account.
So India was paying for Britain to conquer other countries.
In many cases, yes. And my favorite example, because it's so often misunderstood, the railways.
Ah, the railways. This is usually held up as the great gift of the British Raj. We gave you trains. We civilized you.
Physically, yes, they built tracks. But financially, it was a racket. An absolute racket. The capital to build the railways was raised in London from private British investors. The colonial government guaranteed them a 5% return on their investment.
5% doesn't sound like a lot today, with modern inflation.
In the 19th century, when British government bonds, you know, the safest investment on earth, were paying 2% or maybe 3%, a government guaranteed 5% was a gold mine. It was a license to print money.
And what if the railways didn't make enough profit to pay that 5%?
The Indian taxpayer made up the difference.
Of course they did.
So you had a situation where India was borrowing money from Britain to build infrastructure that was primarily designed to help extract raw materials more efficiently and move troops to quell rebellions, and then paying a guaranteed high rate of interest on that debt to London forever.
So India was paying for the construction and maintenance of its own cave.
In every sense. And while this financial drain was happening, there was a simultaneous physical destruction occurring on the ground. Deindustrialization.
This is the concept of ruralization. I think we forget that prior to the 1800s, India wasn't just a farm. It was a manufacturing powerhouse.
It was the textile workshop of the world. Not an exaggeration. Indian cottons, muslins, silks, they were the best in the world, the most sought-after luxury goods. But after 1813, the East India Company lost its monopoly, and the British government introduced a policy of one-way free trade.
Which means exactly what it sounds like, I assume.
It means British machine-made textiles from Manchester could come into India duty-free. Zero tax. They flooded the market with cheap cloth. But if an Indian weaver wanted to sell his hand-woven cloth in Britain...
Let me guess. High taxes.
He faced tariffs ranging from 70% to 400%.
400%. That's not a tariff. That's a ban. You're not trying to raise revenue, you're trying to kill an industry.
You're killing it. It effectively shut Indian goods out of the global market and even made them uncompetitive in their own home market. The result was that the spinning industry, the people who made yarn, was wiped out. Millions of artisans who used to make a living making cloth were forced out of business.
And where do they go?
They have nowhere to go but back to the village, back to the land.
Overburdening the agriculture sector.
Exactly. The percentage of the population dependent on industry collapsed. The pressure on land became immense. This is why, by 1947, India was an agrarian economy. It wasn't naturally that way. It was forced into that shape by deliberate policy.
And the land they were forced back onto wasn't exactly a paradise either. We have to talk about the land tenure systems quickly because the sources identify this as the root of the inequality we still see today.
Right. It all comes down to revenue. The colonial state needed stable, predictable revenue. They didn't care about harvest cycles or droughts. They wanted their cash on a fixed date. So in 1793, Lord Cornwallis introduced the permanent settlement, or zamindari system, in Bengal and Bihar.
This is where they created the absentee landlord class?
Yes. They essentially optioned off the right to collect taxes. They designated certain people as zamindars, proprietors of the land. The state demanded a fixed revenue from them forever, in perpetuity. The zamindar, in turn, could collect whatever he wanted from the peasants, as long as he paid the British their cut.
So the zamindar has zero incentive to invest in the land, to build a well or improve the soil. His only incentive is to squeeze the tenant as hard as possible.
He invests nothing. He just racks up the rent. If the tenant can't pay, he's evicted. This created a parasitic class of rent seekers who often didn't even live in the villages. And even in the South, where they had the Raiwari system.
That's where the state dealt directly with the peasant, right?
Right. In theory, it was better. The state dealt with the individual peasant, the Raiwar. But the taxes were so high and so rigidly enforced that if the harvest failed even once, the peasant had to run to a moneylender.
And that's the beginning of the debt trap.
It's the beginning of the end. You take one loan at an exorbitant rate, you can't pay it back, you lose your land. This created the modern class of landless agricultural laborers.
So fast forward. It's August 15th, 1947. The British leave. What do they leave behind? Let's take stock.
They leave behind a literacy rate of 18%, a life expectancy in the low 30s, a savings rate of just 9%, an agriculture sector that is overburdened and stagnant, and an industrial base that barely exists.
That is the crime scene, a shattered economy. Now, enter the architects. Part two. It's 1950, we have a new government, a new constitution, and a massive, massive problem. How do you jumpstart an economy that has been stalled for two centuries?
You plan. You have to.
Yeah.
This brings us to the era of the Planning Commission and the five-year plans. You have to remember the context of the time. In 1950, the Soviet Union was growing faster than anyone else. Central planning looked like the modern scientific way to do things. Capitalism was associated with colonialism.
So the state had to take the lead. The famous five-year plans.
The first plan, from 1951 to 56, was actually quite modest. It was based on something called the Herod-Domar model.
That sounds technical, but the logic behind it is pretty simple, right?
Very simple. The model just says your economic growth depends on two things. How much you save and invest, your savings rate, and how efficient you are at turning that capital into output, what economists call the capital output ratio.
So more savings and more efficiency equals more growth.
That's it. And since India was capital poor, the first plan focused on the absolute basics. Agriculture. We needed to recover from the trauma of partition, which had cut off major food-growing areas, and we needed to ensure food security. Dams. Irrigation.
And did it work?
It did, kind of. Growth hit 3.6%, which was better than the 0% of the colonial era. But a lot of that success was just because the monsoons were kind. The rains were good.
A lucky break.
A very lucky break. But the real shift, the big structural break that defined the next 30 years, comes with the second plan in 1956. This is the Nehru-Mahalanobis strategy.
This is the big one. P.C. Mahalanobis. He wasn't even an economist, was he?
No. He was a physicist and a statistician. A brilliant one. He founded the Indian Statistical Institute. And he looked at India's problem through a very mathematical structural lens. He said, look, we can't just keep exporting tea and cotton to buy machines from the West. That's the colonial trap all over again.
So what was his solution?
He said, if we want to be truly independent, truly self-reliant, we need to make the machines that make the machines.
Heavy industry, steel plants, dams, power stations, the temples of modern India, as Nehru called them.
Exactly. The philosophy was unbalanced growth. He knew that pouring all our limited capital into heavy industry would not create immediate consumer goods. You wouldn't get more shoes or more cloth or more bicycles right away. In fact, you might get fewer for a while.
So it was a deliberate trade-off. Slower consumption growth now for industrial capacity later. It's like a family choosing to eat simply for years so they can save up to build their own house from scratch.
That's a great way to think about it. And to do this, they close the economy. Import substitution industrialization. We will make everything ourselves, was the idea. But the sources mentioned there was a dissenting view, a road not taken.
Right. Two economists named Vakil and Brahmananda.
The wage goods model. It's one of the great what-ifs of Indian economic history.
Mm.
Vakil and Brahmananda argued that Mahalanobis was making a fundamental mistake. They said, in a poor country with millions of idle workers, your main constraint isn't just a lack of machines. It's a lack of food. It's a lack of cloth. It's the basic stuff workers need to survive.
What they called wage goods.
Exactly. Their argument was simple. If you put millions of people to work building these massive steel plants, you have to pay them wages. And what's the first thing they're going to do with that money?
They're going to want to buy food.
Yeah.
And clothes for their family.
Right. But if you've neglected agriculture and consumer goods industries to focus only on steel, there won't be enough food or cloth to buy.
Yeah.
And when you have too much money chasing too few goods, what happens?
Inflation. Prices go through the roof.
And that's exactly what they warned would happen. They said ignoring wage goods would cause a crisis of inflation and shortages. And unfortunately for India, by the mid-1960s, they were proven completely right.
The 60s seemed like a nightmare decade for the economy, a perfect storm of problems.
It was the turbulent decade, a lost decade, some call it. The third plan failed catastrophically. You have the war with China in 62, which exposed our industrial and military weakness. Then the war with Pakistan in 65.
And on top of that, nature wasn't cooperating.
Back-to-back severe droughts in 65 and 66, the agricultural base just collapsed. We were literally living ship-to-mouth on American food aid, the PL-480 program where they sent us wheat.
A humiliating position for a country that prided itself on self-reliance.
Deeply humiliating.
Right.
It got so bad they had to hit the pause button on the entire five-year plan model. They had what's called the plan holiday from 1966 to 1969.
But ironically, this crisis forced a necessary pivot, right?
It did. The government realized they couldn't ignore agriculture anymore. This was the moment they launched the Green Revolution in earnest. High-yielding variety seeds for wheat and rice, massive investment in fertilizers, pesticides, irrigation. This was the moment India decided to secure its food sovereignty, whatever the cost.
Then we move into the 70s. The slogan changes. It's no longer just about growth. It's Garibi Hatao, remove poverty.
This was the fifth plan under Indira Gandhi. It marked a significant political shift toward redistribution. The realization was that the Mahalanobis model of growth wasn't trickling down fast enough. You needed direct intervention, nationalizing banks, for example, to help the poor. But then we hit the 1980s.
The 80s are interesting because on paper, the growth looked good, didn't it? We finally broke that stagnant Hindu rate of growth of 3.5% that had plagued us for decades. We started hitting 5 or 6%.
We did. The Hindu rate of growth was a pejorative term, but it captured that feeling of stagnation. And in the 80s, we finally seemed to be breaking free. But it was a false dawn. It was growth fueled by what economists call fiscal profligacy.
We were growing by borrowing.
Massively. The government was spending way, way beyond its means, running up huge deficits, both internal and external.
It's like a family appearing wealthy by maxing out all their credit cards.
Exactly. It looks like a boom. You've got a new car, a new TV, but the bills are piling up. You're setting yourself up for a bust. You're creating a bubble of debt that is just waiting to pop.
And that bust arrived right on schedule. Which brings us to part three, the watershed. 1991. The year everything changed.
The year the music stopped.
So, set the scene for us. It's 1990-91. What is happening that pushes this debt-fueled economy over the edge?
It was the perfect storm. Three things hit at once. First, you have the underlying condition. Those massive fiscal deficits from the 80s had made the economy incredibly fragile. Then, geopolitics intervened. Saddam Hussein invades Kuwait. The Gulf War begins.
And oil prices go through the roof.
Through the roof. And India imports most of its oil. So our import bill skyrockets literally overnight. At the exact same time, because of the war, remittances for the hundreds of thousands of Indian workers in the Gulf, they stop.
So money is gushing out for oil, but the money that usually comes in from workers abroad has dried up.
A double whammy.
Yeah.
And what's happening back home?
Political chaos.
Utter chaos. We had these shaky coalition governments that were falling apart every few months. International investors and lenders looked at this mess. the war, the oil prices, the political instability, and they lost confidence completely. They started pulling their money out. The credit card was maxed out, and the bank was calling in the loan.
It got down to the absolute wire. The sources say our foreign exchange reserves dropped to just $1.2 billion.
It's hard to convey how terrifying that is. That is enough money to pay for about 3 weeks of essential imports.
3 weeks.
3 weeks. Imagine a country the size of India, 850 million people at the time, having only enough cash to buy oil and other essentials for 3 more weeks. After that, the lights go out. We were on the absolute verge of defaulting on our international debt payments for the first time in our history.
And the government had to do something desperate, something that became a symbol of this crisis. The gold airlift.
It is such a visceral image. To secure an emergency loan from the IMF and the Bank of England, the Reserve Bank of India had to physically fly 47 tons of its gold reserves to London to pledge as collateral.
For a country where gold is so culturally significant, where it represents family honor, security, the goddess Lakshmi.
It was a profound national humiliation. It was seen as selling the family silver to pay the grocery bill. But it was also the shock treatment we needed. It was the moment the entire political class across all parties realized. The old model is dead. It's over. We cannot continue like this.
Enter the reformers. The new prime minister, P.V. Narasimha Rao, and his surprise choice for finance minister, a technocrat named Manmohan Singh, they launched the LPG reforms. Liberalization, privatization, globalization.
And they didn't just apply a band-aid to fix the immediate crisis. They performed open-heart surgery. They rewired the entire economic machine.
Let's talk about the biggest thing they dismantled, the license raj. Because for a young listener today, or someone outside India, this system sounds like it's from a dystopian novel.
It really does. Before 1991, if you were a business owner and you wanted to build a new factory, you needed a license from the government.
Yeah.
If you wanted to expand your existing factory and produce more, you needed another license.
And if you wanted to change the product you were making, say you were making spoons and saw a market for forks?
You needed a license for that too.
It's unbelievable. And getting these licenses took years, I assume.
Years of paperwork, of lobbying in Delhi, of bribery, of red tape. It was designed to give bureaucrats total control. It completely stifled innovation and competition. The industrial policy of 1991 abolished this overnight. It scrapped industrial licensing for almost everything except a few hazardous or strategic industries.
Suddenly, Indian businesses could breathe. They could actually make business decisions instead of just managing bureaucracy.
And they opened the windows to the world. Trade policy was transformed. Tariffs, which are just taxes on imports, were slashed. In 1991, peak tariffs were over 150%. Imagine paying double or triple the global price for any imported machinery or component. They started slashing those down. They devalued the rupee to make our exports cheaper and more competitive.
And crucially, they started fixing the plumbing, the financial system. This is where the first Narasimha Committee comes in.
Yes, Narasimha Committee the first in 1991. The committee's diagnosis of the banking system was summed up in two words, financial repression.
That sounds ominous. What does it mean?
It was. It meant that banks were not free to be banks. They were forced by the government to keep a huge chunk of their money locked up with the government itself. This was done through two main levers, the SLR, or statutory liquidity ratio, and the CRR, or cash reserve ratio.
So what were those ratios like before 1991?
Combined, they were nearly 60%.
Mm.
So for every 100 rupees you deposited in a bank, the bank had to turn around and park nearly 60 rupees with the government, often at very low interest rates.
Which left very little money for them to lend out to businesses, to entrepreneurs, to people who wanted to build things.
Exactly. Narasimha said, stop using banks as a piggy bank for the government. Drastically lower these ratios. Let them do their actual job, which is to lend money to the productive parts of the economy.
This is a huge shift, and it brings us to part four. Rewiring the system. Because 1991 wasn't the end of the reforms, it was just the chaotic, necessary beginning.
Right. If 1991 was about letting the market breathe, about efficiency, the reforms of the late 90s and 2000s were about making sure the system didn't blow up. They were about safety and stability.
So let's talk about the banking reforms that followed. There was a second Narasimha Committee in 1998.
Narasimha II. This is where we start getting serious about aligning Indian banking with global best practices. This is what brought in the concept of capital adequacy norms, the Basel norms.
Okay, can you explain that in simple terms? What is capital adequacy?
Think of it like a seatbelt or an airbag for a bank. If a bank lends you money and you don't pay it back, the bank takes a loss. Capital adequacy is a rule that says the bank must have enough of its own money, its equity capital sitting in the vault, to absorb those potential losses without going bankrupt and, more importantly, without losing the depositor's money.
Got it. It's the bank's own skin in the game. It's the buffer that protects the public.
The buffer, exactly. And then they gave banks teeth to recover bad loans. The Sarfeesi Act in 2002 was a game changer. Before this, if you were a big industrialist and you defaulted on a loan, the bank was helpless. The court system would take 20 years to resolve a case.
So you could just default on a billion-rupee loan and keep driving your Mercedes.
Pretty much. Sarfeesi gave banks the power to seize the assets of defaulters, the factory, the house, without having to go through the courts first. It completely shifted the power balance between lenders and borrowers.
Now, let's talk about how we manage money at the highest level today, the monetary policy. For years, this was a bit of a black box. The RBI governor would just make a decision. But the sources highlight a major game changer in the 2014-2016 period, the Urjit Patel Committee.
This is absolutely crucial for anyone following the economy today. Before this committee, the RBI had multiple, often conflicting goals. You know, keep growth high, but also keep the exchange rate stable. Oh, and by the way, please keep inflation low. It was messy. Urjit Patel's committee came in and said, stop, you have one primary overriding goal, inflation.
This is the birth of inflation targeting in India.
Specifically, flexible inflation targeting. The government and the RBI formally agreed on a target. That target is 4%.
With a bit of wiggle room on either side.
Yes, a tolerance band of plus or minus 2%. So anywhere between 2% and 6% is the safe zone. If inflation goes above 6% for three consecutive quarters, the RBI is officially considered to have failed. And the governor has to write a letter to the government explaining why and what they're going to do about it.
And they changed who decides. It's no longer just the RBI governor sitting alone in a tower making the call.
Right. And this is a huge step for transparency and accountability. They created the Monetary Policy Committee, or MPC. It has six members, three senior experts from the RBI, including the governor, and three independent experts appointed by the government. They vote on interest rates, and the minutes of their meetings are published.
So you can see who voted for what and why.
Exactly. And crucially, they anchored the whole system to one specific measure of inflation, the CPI, or Consumer Price Index.
And that's the inflation you feel when you go to the supermarket and buy groceries, right? Not the wholesale price index.
Correct. For decades, they were obsessed with the wholesale price index, which tracks the price of goods at the factory gate. But that doesn't include services, and it doesn't reflect what the common person, the admite, is actually feeling in their household budget. Shifting to CPI aligned the central bank's policy with the reality of the street.
While we are on the topic of financial plumbing, I want to quickly hit a couple of key terms from our jargon buster in the sources. Deficits. We hear this all the time on the news. Fiscal deficit versus revenue deficit. What's the simple way to distinguish them?
Think of your own household budget. The fiscal deficit is your total borrowing for the year. Now, if you borrow money to build an extension on your house or to pay for your kids' college education, that's generally seen as okay. You're borrowing to create a long-term asset. That's like the government's capital expenditure.
Okay, that makes sense. It's an investment.
Exactly. But the revenue deficit is when you borrow money just to pay for your groceries, your electricity bill, or your Netflix subscription. That is the bad one. It implies you are living beyond your means just for daily survival. You aren't building anything. You're just racking up credit card debt to consume.
Got it. So we want the revenue deficit to be as close to zero as possible, even if the fiscal deficit is a bit higher, because we're investing in things like roads and ports.
That is the goal of every responsible government. You borrowed to build, not to consume.
Perfect. And one more quick one. Buoyancy versus elasticity when we talk about taxes. The source used a great boat analogy, which I thought was brilliant.
I love this analogy. Imagine tax revenue is a boat. And the GDP, the size of the economy, is the tide. As the tide GDP rises, the boat should naturally rise with it.
Makes sense. A bigger economy should mean more tax revenue.
Right. Buoyancy measures the total rise of that boat. But that total rise includes the captain, the finance minister, actively bailing water into the boat or changing the sails. In other words, raising tax rates or adding new taxes like the GST.
So buoyancy measures everything, the effect of natural economic growth, plus the effect of policy changes.
Exactly. Elasticity, on the other hand, is a purer measure. It tries to calculate how much the boat would have risen naturally with the tide if the captain had done absolutely nothing. It measures the inherent efficiency of the tax system itself.
So we want high elasticity.
We want very high elasticity. If elasticity is low, it means the system is leaky. The economy is growing, but tax collection isn't keeping up naturally, so the government has to keep hiking tax rates just to get more money.
That is surprisingly clear. Okay, let's pivot. We've spent a lot of time building this complex economic machine, Basel norms, inflation targets, free trade. But the big question is it working for the people? Let's talk about part five, the human element, specifically poverty.
And measuring poverty in India has been a political and intellectual battlefield for decades. It's not just a mathematical exercise. It defines government policy and legacies. It started, quite simply, with calories. The Alar Task Force in 1979 set the line. They said, if you can't afford to consume 2,400 calories a day in a village or 2,100 in a city, you are poor.
Simple, but a bit crude, no. I could eat 2,400 calories of pure sugar every day and be technically not poor by that measure, even if I live in a shack and have no access to health care.
Exactly. It was a survival line, not a line for a dignified life. It ignored health, education, shelter, everything else. So after decades of debate, the government appointed the Tendulkar Committee, which reported in 2009. This was a massive methodological shift.
How so?
They moved away from just calories and moved to a broader consumption basket. For the first time, they included household spending on education and health in the poverty line. They said being not poor means being able to afford a basic level of these things, too.
That seems much more sensible. But didn't this cause a massive controversy?
It did. Because when they translated this basket back into a rupee figure, the poverty line they set, something like 27 rupees a day in villages and 33 in cities, was considered ridiculously low by the public and the media. People said, you can't even buy a proper meal for that, let alone live on it. It became a huge political storm.
So the government set up another committee to review it.
Yes, the Rangarajan Committee, which reported in 2014, they tried to find a middle path. They went back to a mix of calories, but also added protein and fat requirements, and observed consumer behavior. Unsurprisingly, they set the line higher. So while the Tendulkar method said 21.9% of Indians were poor in 2011, Rangarajan's method said, no, it's actually closer to 29.5%.
It just shows how moving the goalpost completely changes the score.
Always. But the modern way of looking at it, and this is what Niti Aayog, the government's think tank, uses now, is the MPI, the Multidimensional Poverty Index.
And this stops looking at just money or consumption altogether.
Right. It asks a series of simple, direct questions about your life. Do you have a bank account? Is your house made of proper materials? Do you have access to clean cooking fuel? Is any child in your family out of school? It uses 12 such indicators across health, education, and standard of living.
And the numbers there are quite hopeful from what I read.
They are genuinely impressive. The most recent report, which covers the period between 2015-16 and 2019-21, shows the number of multidimensionally poor people dropping from roughly 25% of the population to just under 15%. That means 13.5 crore people, that's 135 million people, escaped multidimensional poverty in just 5 years.
That's a population larger than Germany or the UK.
It's a huge success story.
Okay, that's the good news. That's the India shining, the global powerhouse narrative. But then we open the State of Inequality Report from 2022, and this hit me hard.
Yes, the other side of the coin. The concentration of wealth and income.
The numbers are stark. The top 1% of the population holds about 6-7% of the total income. The top 10% holds about a third. But here's the one stat that really puts it all in perspective for our listeners. The report found that to be in the top 10% of Indian earners, you need to earn a salary of just 25,000 euros a month.
25,000 rupees. Let that sink in.
That is a massive reality check. We all live in our own bubbles. But to be in the top decile of earners in a country of 1.4 billion people requires a salary that, in a major metro city like Mumbai or Bangalore or Delhi, would barely cover rent and basic living expenses for one person. It just shows how incredibly low the base of the pyramid really is.
It highlights what economists call the K-shaped recovery, or K-shaped growth. The formal, organized, skilled part of the economy is doing very well. The top 10% are consuming, traveling, investing in the stock market. But the bottom 50% are still struggling with basic income security and stagnant wages.
And this connects directly to the employment situation. The sources mention the PLFS, the Periodic Labor Force Survey. The headline unemployment number is low, around 3.2%, which sounds great, but there's a catch.
There's a big catch. The quality of employment is the real issue. What we're seeing in the data is a worrying rise in the category of unpaid helper in household enterprises, especially for women in rural areas.
That isn't a job in the modern sense. That's just helping out on the family farm or in the family shop because there are no other paying jobs available.
It's disguised unemployment. It's survival. and we are also seeing a trend of re-agriculturalization. For the first time in decades, the share of the workforce in agriculture is actually going up. People who left the villages for construction or factory jobs in the cities are moving back to the farms because there aren't enough stable formal jobs.
Speaking of farms, though, the production side is booming. Record food grain production, over 357 million tons projected for 2024-25.
The granaries are full. We have solved the problem of food availability at the macro level. And the MSP, the minimum support price system, is absolutely central to this. The official formula for setting MSP is A2 plus FL multiplied by 1.5.
Okay, break that down for us. What is A2 plus FL?
A2 represents the actual paid out costs for the farmer, what he spends on seeds, fertilizer, pesticides, hired labor, fuel for the tractor. FL stands for family labor. It's the imputed value of the farmer's own toil and his family's unpaid work on the farm.
So the government calculates that total cost and then guarantees a price that gives the farmer a 50% profit margin over it.
That's the formula. It's the safety net for the Indian farmer.
Which brings us perfectly to the safety net for the rural worker. And this is where we get to the very recent developments. Part 6. We all know about MGNREGA, the Mahatma Gandhi National Rural Employment Guarantee Act. It's been around since 2005.
Right. It was a revolutionary piece of legislation. It guaranteed 100 days of manual labor work per rural household on demand. It was the world's largest public works program and a crucial lifeline. But as of December 2025, the landscape has shifted significantly.
The sources identify a new overarching mission that has replaced it. Viksit Bharat Guarantee for Rozgar and Ajivika Mission, or simply Gramin.
Gramin. This was the big announcement in late 2025. It replaces and subsumes MGNREGA. And the key upgrade here, the headline change, is the increase in the number of guaranteed days of work.
It went from 100 days to 125 days per household.
That's a 25% increase in the size of the safety net. That is a significant expansion of the state's commitment to rural employment.
And the focus has shifted too, right? It's not just about, as critics used to say, digging holes and filling them up again.
No. The mission statement for Gramin explicitly focuses on creating durable and sustainable infrastructure. They want the work to be directed towards assets that improve rural productivity in the long run, things like water conservation structures, rural connectivity, soil regeneration projects. It's an attempt to make the safety net more productive, not just a dole.
And looking at the macro picture for the coming year, 2025-26, the budget targets are very interesting. We are looking at a fiscal deficit target of 4.4% of GDP.
Which is a very strong signal of fiscal consolidation. Remember the fiscal profligacy of the 1980s that led to the 91 crisis? It seems we learned that lesson. Even while launching massive, expensive schemes like Gramin, the government is trying to stick to a pre-announced glide path to bring its borrowing down year after year.
So it's a delicate balancing act.
A very delicate balancing act, spending on the poor and on infrastructure, while keeping the bond markets and credit rating agencies happy by showing fiscal discipline.
So let's bring it all together. After this journey through 200 years of economic history, what does this all mean? Where are we now?
If you look at the arc, it's just incredible. We started at a crime scene, an economy literally designed to be extracted, where the country's own tax money was used to pay for its exports. We went through the temple building phase of heavy industry making machines to make machines, closing ourselves off from the world. We hit the wall in 1991, the perfect storm, and were forced to reinvent ourselves as a market-driven, globalized economy.
And now, what is this current phase?
Now we are in a phase of refinement and complexity. We have the engine of growth, which is largely market-driven. We have built the guardrails of stability, inflation targeting, Basel norms for banks. And we are now trying to build a much more sophisticated social safety net, a floor beneath it all with Gramin, with the MPI. The basic machinery is modern and in place.
But the core challenge remains.
The core challenge is that statistic you mentioned. The fact that $25,000 a month puts you in the top 10%. We have, by and large, solved the problem of starvation. The granaries are full. We are making huge strides in solving the problem of multidimensional poverty. Electricity, bank accounts, and cooking gas are reaching almost everyone. But we have not yet solved the problem of dignified income.
And that is the final thought we want to leave with you, our listeners, today. We have record grain production. We have a plummeting multidimensional poverty index. We have a digital public infrastructure that is the envy of the world. But as the new Gramin mission kicks in post-2025, the question isn't just, can we grow? We know we can.
The fundamental question for the next decade is this. Can the quality of employment catch up to the quantity of growth? Can we move millions of people from being unpaid helpers in household enterprises to having formal jobs with regular salaries that are enough to break that 25,000 ceiling? That is the next chapter of the Indian economy.
Something to think about next time you read a headline about GDP growth. Look past the big number. Look at the structure. Look at the history. Thank you for listening to this deep dive.
It's been a pleasure.
We'll catch you on the next one.